Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. WNYC. Picture this. You're a diplomat attending the 2009 G20 summit in London. You have to send a few emails, download a presentation you're giving tomorrow morning on nuclear security. So you pop into the internet cafe conveniently located off the lobby. But the thing is, it's not really an internet cafe. It's a fake internet cafe set up by British intelligence in partnership with the National Security Agency of the United States to lure diplomats and others just in case some valuable intel passes through their computers. This fake internet cafe trick turns out to be just one of about two dozen James Bond-like tricks that we now know the NSA has up its sleeve. Culling from the reporting and original source documents leaked by Edward Snowden, The Brian Lehrer Show has compiled a running list of what we know the NSA can do: hacking into email servers, tapping underwater fiber optic cables, monitoring online games, and lots, lots more. You can see the list at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or we've just tweeted it again. Follow us at Brian Lehrer. And joining us to go through the list and add a little context is Shane Harris, senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Shane, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's good to talk to you again. Thanks.
And we know about the metadata program to monitor phone information, but let's go through a few of the crazier things on this list. Want to start with that fake internet cafe? Really?
Yeah, I think this is one of the more surprising. James Bond maybe is a good analogy for this. I mean, in the sense that they are looking for communications from foreign diplomats and dignitaries and government officials, that in and of itself is not that surprising. But the setup that they used of actually sort of luring people into what they supposed was a safe place for sending communications, that's a pretty stunning one, and very clever, obviously. I mean, obviously, this was a summit that was held in London, so it was a little bit easier for the British to do this.
Of course, it's a real internet cafe in that they can actually send and receive messages and do all the things you would do online. It's just completely also a pipeline to intelligence, right?
Right. Think of it that, I mean, basically everything that they're doing on those computers is being watched and being copied by the GCHQ, which is the Brits surveillance agency, and then also shared with us. So they're going about doing their business thinking that perhaps no one's watching them, when in fact someone is watching or recording everything that they're typing and everything that they're sending.
And there are a number of other things on the list along those same lines. The NSA can set up fake cell phone base stations to intercept phone calls, or fake wireless networks to then capture data. Any of this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me in the aggregate. I mean, I'm a little bit biased as somebody who spent a number of years researching a book on the NSA. Many of these things are what you would expect a very large intelligence agency with a very large budget as it has to be able to try to do. But when you drill down into some of these specific examples, some of them are really stunning. There are feats of ingenuity on display here. There's trickery, there's deception. Again, things that you would associate with an intelligence agency. But when you list them out the way that you all have, it is quite arresting, I think.
And on those kinds of things, the fake wireless networks, the fake internet cafe, isn't there some sort of entrapment going on there?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if you think about intelligence in terms of, is there a morality or any kind of legality to intelligence and how it's practiced among nations, there really isn't. I mean, a lot of these officials who I gather had their communications slurped up at this internet cafe arguably should have known or expected that the British Intelligence Service would try to spy on them when they were at an international summit meeting. I think the question maybe becomes more acute when we're talking about the agency spying on ordinary people or on gathering communications from private individuals as opposed to trying to spy on diplomats, which is something that intelligence services have been doing to each other, for centuries, really.
Listeners, any questions or comments about our list of what the NSA can do? 212-433 WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. All right, let's keep going down this list. A few others that might surprise people. They can hack into the UN video conferencing system, can intercept communications between aircraft and airports. They can physically intercept deliveries, open packages, and make changes to devices. And on yesterday's show, we mentioned that the NSA could set up a fake LinkedIn account, but I actually misspoke. It can set up a fake LinkedIn, like set up an entire fake social network to lure people into joining and saying whatever it is that the NSA is looking for. Any others along those lines that you would add?
You know, you're getting now into these very kind of like almost exquisite examples of where really refined kind of, you know, high-end sort of targeting and, you know, setting up fake websites and the diversion of the shipments and all that. There's a very small group of really elite hackers within the NSA, maybe only a few hundred people who work on these projects at any one time. One of the ones that actually surprised me, which is not directly on your list, is the work that they did to reportedly insert a flawed encryption algorithm into a product manufactured by a company called RSA. Most people may not know what that company is, but chances are very good that you're the beneficiary of its encryption products when you send emails, when you bank, when you do any number of things online, and your data is kept secure and encrypted. Some years ago, it reportedly, the NSA arranged to install a backdoor effectively into one of those products so that it would give it access to unencrypted communications in the future. These are really highly specialized, specific applications that take time and a lot of engineering know-how to pull off and a lot of money to do it as well. It is extraordinary that we're learning such detail about these now. These are the kinds of things that the things that you have listed here on the website are things that the NSA would look at and consider probably some of its biggest operational secrets. And I think probably their head has been spinning for the past 7 months that all of this stuff has now come out publicly.
Revealed by Snowden, and
yes,
including all these what you might call boutique spy operations.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned one that is not on our list, and folks, this list is open, whether you're Shane Harris, who wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, or anybody else who knows something to propose that we confirm and add to the list, tweeted at Brian Lehrer. But do you have a sense of how big some of these boutique programs are? I mean, are there a dozen full-time employees at the NSA who spend their entire day exclusively trolling through online video games to monitor for terrorist activity, or are they trying smaller, shorter-term pilot projects to see what sticks? How much do you know?
Yeah, my sense is it is more the latter, that a lot of these, I mean, some of these documents that have come out appear to be from a moment in time, and it's not clear whether or not the projects had been going on for some time before or whether they continued. You know, the elite group that I mentioned before, which is called the Tailored Access Operations Group at NSA, these are the really high-end hackers. These are the ones who are responsible for doing things like diverting shipments of computers and installing surveillance equipment on them before they send them back on their way. I've heard from sources who've worked there that there are probably only about 300 people who work in that office. That is a very small number of people with a really high sort of skill set. Now, the agency itself has reportedly 30,000 people, but I think we have to presume that on these really high-end surveillance operations, it's a much smaller, it's a fraction of that overall workforce, and that they probably absolutely are trying things out, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't. You have a mention on the list here about the NSA trying to get into the Tor network, which is a routing service that allows people to connect to the Internet anonymously. It appears that from the documents that Snowden released, they tried quite unsuccessfully to overcome the anonymizing features of that network and very well may have stopped trying to foil it, at least for some time. Maybe they came back to it. But it would not be unexpected at all for them to try something. If it works, keep doing it. And if it doesn't, to abandon it and move on to something else, because, you know, they're limited with the number of people and the amount of money that they have. Even for an agency with a multi-billion-dollar budget, they have to be smart about how they invest that money.
Yeah. Did you see the great segment on the Colbert Report where they imagined an online video game where every character was actually an undercover NSA agent awkwardly trying to extract information from each other?
I didn't see that, but, you know, doesn't it just, like, raise the possibility? I mean, you wonder, I mean, how many of these times are they bumping into each other out there, and is this stuff actually working? I mean, that's like a great send-up.
Yeah, it's like a Cold War parody. Wait, you work for the NSA? I work for the NSA. Eric in Tenafly, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I just wanted to comment briefly about what nobody really talks about, and that the terrorist organizations and organized crimes don't utilize regular means of communications like text messages, emails, in order to send their plans from one to another. They use highly sophisticated encryption formats that are almost impossible to crack. And then when they do send content, they use code names and things. They don't put their full names and addresses and phone numbers like regular communication. Nobody's really talking about that and the futility of the entire NSA program to get real meaningful information about the massive terrorist organizations out there. You know, the bad guys know this is happening. They're taking steps way ahead of this to communicate in very, very covert ways.
Shane, what do you think about that? I mean, they do, right? There was an Al-Qaeda plot foiled last year when we found out that all of the main leaders were on a conference call together. So it's a really important question if we're going to, you know, debate the ethics of this, is also to understand the efficacy of this. So do these boutique programs, do these larger programs work to any extent that we can know?
It's a very, very difficult question to say, to look at one program and say, did this stop a terrorist attack? I mean, the best example we have of this is the collection of Americans' phone records, the so-called metadata program. The government started out when that was revealed by saying somewhere around 50 or so terrorist plots had been stopped. They scaled that number back. Subsequently, independent reviews have looked at this and questioned whether it stopped any attacks. But the NSA does not necessarily look at a particular program and measure its efficacy that way. They're not looking so much at did it or did it not stop an attack, because that's actually quite hard to measure. But how far into the network did we penetrate? How many leads did we generate? How much product, they'll call it that, product, did we generate out of this that ended up in an intelligence report for the president or for another senior official? You mentioned the instance of the so-called Al-Qaeda conference call of doom. That was actually just almost a bit of a stroke of luck that information was intercepted actually by an Air Force analyst and then was shared with the NSA. Occasionally, these systems and these programs that are in place are going to catch something, but it's, I think, very difficult to step back and measure each one on how many plots it has stopped or how many it has missed. But, you know, the caller points to something that is so fundamental to this. The reason why the NSA is working so hard to break encryption, to penetrate networks like Tor, to overcome a lot of these other obstacles on the Internet is because criminals and terrorist groups are using those very technologies to hide what they're doing.
And I
guess that is the motivation for the NSA in many cases to do what it's doing here.
And I guess the companion question, if, as you say, the NSA is freaking out at how many of these boutique programs and other super secret things Snowden actually revealed, the companion question is, what has been damaged in terms of national security by letting these things out? Is that a knowable topic?
I think likewise, that's also hard to know. A number of senior administration officials have now said publicly on the record that the Snowden leaks did do damage to national security. The most specific that they have gotten is to say that the Al-Qaeda cells and groups that they have been monitoring, in their view, have changed their tactics as a result of the leaks. They're trying to do things now to evade the surveillance that's out there, or what they think it can do. The National Counterterrorism Director recently said that they've picked up chatter among Al-Qaeda operatives talking about the Snowden leaks. So in their mind, yes, it has had some effect. But again, very difficult to measure. And I would also just, you know, underscore here, this is to some degree is the price you pay in living in an open society. I mean, to say nothing for, you know, put aside the question of Mr. Snowden's motives or whether it did or not do damage, when journalists report on these things, we try and do the best that we can to minimize sensitive operational information, but you weigh that against the public's right and the need to know about this information. So you can't have, you know, transparency of an intelligence system in a free society without running the risk that you will jeopardize intelligence operations to some extent.
I think Derek on the Upper West Side has a question about one of the things we mentioned from the list. Derek, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier about the NSA capabilities of tapping fiber optics, and I thought you said undersea fiber optics, but I wasn't quite sure. The reason for my query, and hopefully the author can lend some detail on it, is I worked on a UN project back in 99 or 98, I think it was, and I had a magazine, a internal UN publication magazine, that had an article that said that the NSA tapped an undersea fiber optic cable between England and France and pulled out the Airbus bid on a big project for a new plane, gave it to Boeing, and then Boeing submitted a bid that beat the Airbus bid by one nickel U.S. The interesting thing was last year or the year before, Richard Clark delivered a lecture or something and claimed specifically that the NSA had never spied on commercial businesses to advantage U.S. businesses. And yesterday or the day before, President Obama said that the NSA would not basically do the same thing, spy for commercial purposes. And could you comment on this undersea fiber optic? Because that's got to be really hard to do.
Shane, how familiar are you with that?
Yeah, so it's kind of two questions there. I mean, the case of Airbus and Boeing was one that came up in the late 90s, as your caller said. I'm not as deeply familiar with that as some other cases, but that was an allegation that had been made that the NSA was engaging in industrial espionage, stealing information from a foreign company and giving it to an American competitor so that they could get a leg up. It's something that the agency denied. I believe there were hearings on it in the European Parliament or in the EU. The NSA today insists that they do not engage in that kind of economic espionage. You know, however, what they will do is spy on foreign trade ministers. They will spy on government officials to try and figure out where their countries are going in trade negotiations and other international negotiations so that American officials can get a leg up on that. So it's a variation on the economic-themed espionage, if not actually giving secrets to a corporation. As for the undersea cables, there have been documented cases where NSA has actually used submarines to try and tap cables underneath the water and has had some success with doing that. But more likely than not, what they're doing today is actually tapping the cables when they come to shore, either at those sort of landing stations or in the offices of the companies that own and operate that equipment around the world.
Derek, thank you for your call. And I want to go to a comments page comment by David, who writes, it seems to me that the NSA has evolved from a useful public service person into a demented hoarder who collects everything without knowing what to do with it all. So how insatiable is the NSA's appetite? Or should we see this as, you know, very targeted, very smart, even if they're broad ways of trying to protect the country, whether or not we think they're constitutional?
Well, I think that your caller is putting their finger on something important here, which is that the NSA's strategy is that if they're trying to find the proverbial needle in a haystack, right, they need to collect the entire haystack. So there is this, I think, arguably insatiable quest to collect information and to store it because they don't know what particular piece of information might be valuable and when. The metadata program, again, the phone records program of Americans, it's a great example. Keith Alexander, the agency director, has said publicly that they have to collect all that information so that at some point they have the ability to, his words, go back in time and rebuild someone's social network based on a phone number or a lead that they get. From their perspective, that is the best way that they know how to find useful information is to have access to all of the information going back as far as possible. So that is very much their philosophy, is to collect it. And, you know, if you want to use the word hoarding, I've used it before as well. What it tends to do is, I think, is put the emphasis more on the collection as opposed to the analysis and getting smarter about what you do with that information. And I think that's maybe been one of the where the agency has actually been weak, is that it's focused too much on collecting the dots, if you will, rather than connecting them.
So the Guardian editor, Alan Rusbridger, recently said that the paper has only published 1% of the documents that Edward Snowden stole. So do you expect lots more revelations like this? Are there all sorts of new tricks that will come to light and be added to our list?
I think we have to presume that the answer is yes, yeah, that we're going to see more. Whether or not they will rise to the level of sort of, oh, wow, or be as eye-popping as these, who can say? You know, there have been a number of points in the past 7 months where I thought we had probably heard some of the most spectacular revelations, only to, you know, a week later for another one to drop in the press that just sort of blew my mind. Based on what we know about the number of documents he took and what reporters who received those documents have said, we have only seen, you know, a fraction of the information. And I know that the Guardian and the Post particularly are taking their time with these documents, and they're going through them very carefully and doing very thorough reporting. They're not in a rush to push this information out.
What do you make of the fact that the Guardian and the Times and the Washington Post have taken on this slow trickle approach to revealing NSA activities? I guess you just framed it as basic caution, but every time we hear about a new weird program, there's a bit of a public outcry, and I wonder, do we have a right to know as a public everything right now, especially since the Obama administration is pledging to make changes based on the revelations, and we aren't going to be at this moment of policy change, you know, every 3 months?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that probably, you know, I would have to assume that that is some variation of the question that the editors and reporters at the Post and the Times and the Guardian and other publications are grappling with every day. If they believe that the information in these documents that the public has a need to know and has a right to know it, isn't there an argument to just go ahead and let people see it? From their standpoint, though, what they have said time and again that they want to do is apply sound journalistic methods to this, to be very cautious, to do their due diligence, to thoroughly report it. That is going to take time. And I mean, personally, I think they've made the right choice. I think it is much smarter for them to go through this and apply good reporting and sound judgment to it than to release it all at once, even though if you did that, arguably, people would be able to get through the documents a lot faster. But then we wouldn't know if we were perhaps jeopardizing a program unnecessarily or revealing something that should really stay secret.
Last question. Is there anything you can definitively say the NSA cannot pull off, or will nothing cease to amaze you?
They can't read my mind yet.
I knew you were going to say that. They knew you were going to say that.
Exactly. You know, the one thing that I've been waiting to see whether they can do is actually insert viruses remotely into a computer. We know that they can communicate with viruses and malware already implanted on a machine via radio waves. That's one of the things that's on your list. You know, in my science fiction imagination, I believe they've invented some way to just remotely implant a device without ever having to touch it. But we'll see. We'll find out if I'm right about that.
So Shane Harris, senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. As he tells us, it's the difference between collecting the dots and connecting them. And again, listeners, you can go to our webpage, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show, or go to our Twitter feed where we've just sent this out again, this list that our producer Jody Evergan has compiled from the Snowden documents as revealed in the press and other credible sources of things we now know that the NSA actually can do. Shane, thank you so much.
Brian, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehr on WNYC, and now death and jaywalking on the Upper West Side. This year has already seen some horrific and deadly traffic accidents in the neighborhood, and a tabloid sensation police encounter with an 84-year-old jaywalker. We'll ask what's going on, including whether bad intersection design has anything to do with it, and whether a crackdown on jaywalking, on pedestrians, is part of Mayor de Blasio's Vision Zero program to eliminate traffic deaths altogether. Joining me now is Democratic State Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell, who represents that area, part of the Upper West Side and Morningside Heights. Also joining me is Sam Schwartz, who worked in the New York City Department of Transportation for 20 years. During that time, he served as traffic commissioner and the chief engineer, first deputy commissioner. You also know him as Sam Schwartz, Gridlock Sam, in the Daily News. And he's got some major new proposals for traffic reform in New York City. So, Assemblyman O'Donnell and Sam Schwartz, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this incident first that people may have seen on the cover of the Post. Assemblyman, the 84-year-old named Kang Wong, arrested for jaywalking. There are photos of him bloodied and being walked into a police vehicle. According to reports, it seemed like he couldn't understand officers when they called to him, and that led to his getting arrested. What happened there, as far as you know?
I think you pretty much explained the situation. I don't believe that the man was aware that the police were necessarily trying to do anything. I think that the problem here is let's acknowledge we have a culture in New York City where people jaywalk all the time. And so if you've been jaywalking your whole life or just that's the way you exist, if a police officer comes up to you and tells you not to, you may not even understand why where that's coming from. So So I think that if you're going to, if what we're going to do is focus on enforcement and people jaywalking, that we should start with warnings and start with an education campaign rather than start with arrests and bloodied elderly men.
Assemblyman, that intersection, 96th and Broadway, can be very confusing, especially after it was redesigned. You have to cross twice if you're on the north side of 96th Street to get to the subway entrance. You have to cross 96 and then cross part of Broadway. And there's a left turn signal and various points in the light cycle there that can leave people confused or rushed or perhaps otherwise at risk. One of our colleagues here lives right near there and does not like the new design of that intersection, doesn't feel all that safe there. Do you know that intersection, or are you critical of it at all?
Oh, I know that intersection extraordinarily well. I've been interacting with the city government about that intersection almost my entire tenure, which is now 12 years, representing the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The problems go back to when the city closed the entrance to the West Side Highway from Riverside Drive. That was a dangerous place, and it was the right thing to do. But when they did that, that put all of the traffic that needed to get onto the West Side Highway onto West End and Broadway. Then you had a subway renovation that took away valuable sidewalk space along Broadway. And so they built a new subway entrance and a median, and in expanding the median narrowed the sidewalk. So what ends up happening is you have people having a greater feeling and sense of being crowded and less options of what to do. Then the city decided to put turning lanes off of Broadway onto 96th Street, either coming from north or from south. And for a long time, they were at the same time, which confused the drivers. Now they're consecutive, but most New Yorkers are used to seeing when the light turns red is when you get your walk sign. And what has happened is people are doing that and not realizing that the up-down or downtown Broadway traffic has a turn signal. And so in the end, all those things combined has made it a very dangerous intersection. And I have been talking with the city for years. It's why I put in a bill that would give the city greater authority to control things like that intersection.
Is there an easy fix? I noticed that there's a letter from members of Community Board 7 that recommends a number of things, including changing the signal light pattern along 97th Street, because that's a one-way street. I used to live right there, too, and I know that intersection well. And if you speed, you'll make it from Columbus to Riverside without having to stop after you go across the park at 97th Street. So what are your thoughts about that?
And you're also driving right past a Catholic elementary school, which uses it as a play space during the day. So it's a very, very dangerous street. It's why community opposition to building a nursing home on 97th Street has a lot of legs, because people know how dangerous that intersection is. That intersection at West End in 97th is where the young boy was killed walking legally in a crosswalk with his father.
Yes.
And so clearly it should be evident to anyone that this is a particular problem. Now, the bill that I introduced would lower the standard speed limit in the city to 20, and most importantly, give the city council the authority to change it. We regularly hear here in Albany that the politicians in New York City are sick of coming to us and asking for anything. So my bill says, okay, we'll lower the speed limit to 20, give the city council the authority to set its own speed limits in other places as they see fit. Unfortunately, that bill that I introduced last Thursday requires a home rule message from the city council. So if the city council wants us to move that bill, we have to get a home rule message from them.
Is
to do so.
20 miles an hour is a citywide speed limit, other than on the highways, of course, is pretty low. They're talking now about lowering it from 35 to 30. You would go all the way down to 20?
It would do it as a default. So on my small one street, you know, it would be 20. And if the city DOT and all the experts, you know, decide that some other place, whether that be on Broadway or West End or the West Side Highway or whatever those streets are, that it should be something different. But it would set the default speed limit in the city of New York at 20 and give the authority to the city council to change it as they see fit.
All right. Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell from the Upper West Side, thank you very much. And now we turn to Sam Schwartz, Gridlock Sam, for a bigger view. And listeners, chime in on this. First of all, if you're right in that area on the Upper West Side, if you use the 96th and Broadway subway station or cross that street, how bad is it, and is it worse than it used to be? When I lived in the area, it was before the redesign of the subway station. It seems like people who are there now are finding it worse. Does it need to be redesigned again? What are your nominations as well, if you're elsewhere in the city, for some of the other worst intersections to cross in New York City as a pedestrian? Should jaywalkers be ticketed more, less, or the same as they do now? We'll throw that one in as well. And if we're going to get to Mayor de Blasio's Vision Zero, zero pedestrian deaths, zero traffic deaths in New York City, how about jaywalking? How about shouting out or calling out some of those other worst intersections anywhere in the five boroughs? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Sam Schwartz, you want to weigh in briefly on 96th and Broadway?
First of all, I haven't studied the intersection in great detail, but when I look at the three fatalities that occurred in that area, there are some patterns that do emerge. All were during dark time hours. So one of the things you take a look at is the lighting at the location. Secondly, all the drivers were so-called professional drivers. The ambulance driver, the bus driver, the taxi driver, that may create some kind of pattern. Two out of the three fatals were left turns. Left turns are made faster than right turns. And it looks like in two or three cases, the pedestrians were doing what they should do. So I'm not sure why the crackdown on jaywalking and not the crackdown on failure to yield to pedestrians.
Do you think that a crackdown on jaywalking should be a part of the Vision Zero design? That at least the New York Post article on that incident said that there had been an enforcement push, that cops had been out issuing more jaywalking tickets by design on the Upper West Side, the 96th Street, West 97th Street area in particular.
I don't think that a crackdown on jaywalking is going to have a big effect. I remember the crackdowns on jaywalking during the Wagner days, during the Lindsay days, during the Koch days, during Rudy Giuliani put up pedestrian fences. That's not going to work in New York City, and I'm not sure that that's going to help. Take a look at Los Angeles has a much higher pedestrian fatality rate than New York City, and people don't jaywalk. There's tremendous jaywalking enforcement in Los Angeles where even when the countdown signals get going, so you're not really crossing against the light, they write you a ticket.
Do they really? I didn't know that. I thought the legend about California was that pedestrians always have the right of way, even in the middle of the block, even against the light. So not true.
Well, they do have the right of way, but the pedestrians also may not cross and do not cross for the most part. They do not jaywalk. And yet we have a higher pedestrian fatality rate in Los Angeles than we have in New York City. Sometimes the chaos of New York City does slow down the traffic. There is a whole theory of traffic engineering, and it was first proposed by a Dutch traffic engineer, Hans Mondermann, who removed all traffic control devices and found that the streets became safer. The pedestrian is the king and queen of New York City. Let's focus on the cars and the violations committed by the cars, trucks, and buses.
Elena in Queens wants to call out another dangerous intersection. Elena, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi. I think this is an excellent conversation. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Any of the the stretch of Main Street between Queens Boulevard and the Grand Central, any of those cross streets are a little dangerous, but particularly 84th Road and Main Street. And if you go up a little bit further, 85th Drive and Manton Street is also quite dangerous.
What makes them bad? What makes them bad, Elena?
You have a lot of people coming off. You have the Van Wyck at 84th Drive. You have a lot of people speeding off of that exit of the Van Wyck, and then you have a two-way side street, which is the 84th Road. And so you have traffic coming one way, traffic coming another. It is an apartment building, and a lot of times somebody's double parked, so you can't even see when you're crossing if somebody's going to come. And people just, you know, do not obey speed limits. They come around that corner really, really fast, and I've come within inches of my life at least two or three times in the last, I want to say, 18 months that I've been living in that area, to the point where coming home at night, I've I've invested in several metallic little down jackets because I want to be visible when I'm walking.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically build your case.
Elena, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And it's kind of sad in a way, Sam, right? If people who are just pedestrians feel like they have to wear bright clothing, like we do sometimes when we're on bicycles to make sure that cars see us, then, I don't know, that's a bridge too far. I don't mean to put on those clothes, but it means that something isn't working.
Exactly. You know, and part of it is enforcement. When you take a look at the number of moving violations we write, it's roughly a million two. We look at the number of parking violations, generally between 8 and 10 million. And so we write far more parking violations than we write moving violations. And part of it is that we don't get the revenue directly from the moving violations, but we get all the revenue from the parking violations.
You mentioned this on the show once before, and people went nuts. So explain this again. When the city writes a traffic ticket, they get the revenue, but when they write a speeding ticket, they don't?
Right. When they write a parking ticket, the money stays wholly within the city of New York. When they write a moving violation, the money goes to the State Traffic Violations Bureau, which by formula, New York City gets less than 50% of that revenue.
Do you think that that translates to a policy decision somewhere in City Hall or the traffic department or the NYPD or wherever it is where they say, you know, ease up on the speeding tickets, really go heavy on the traffic tickets because of revenue?
I know exactly where it occurs, and it occurs in the Office of Management and Budget. The Office of Management and Budget looks at the bottom line. The bottom line on parking tickets is, wow, we really make money on parking tickets. On moving violations, we don't make the money. So there isn't that incentive to invest in more cops to do traffic enforcement. I applaud Bratton because he was very good on traffic enforcement the first time around, and I'm expecting really good things, and he did increase the traffic division.
Caroline on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hello, Caroline.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I have seen an inordinate number of accidents. Actually, I called in a couple of years ago after I had seen a woman die in front of me on 106th and Broadway where I live, which is one of the most dangerous intersections. You've got West End and Broadway kind of meeting at 107th Street. And I find that people drive West End and drive Broadway like it's a highway. People go incredibly fast. They also go incredibly fast on the cross streets. I met with de Blasio when he was public advocate and wanted my support when he was running for mayor. He did not know the speed limit in Manhattan. I also have called numerous agencies. I've stopped cops. I asked de Blasio when I met with him, are you legally allowed to make a left turn off of Broadway onto a side street when you have the green light, but the light in the median is red. Following me, so the cross street.
Absolutely. And Sam Schwartz is.
Before you go on,
go ahead.
I have two little kids. I have an 8-year-old and a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old. I take the subway to school with them every morning to 78th Street. We used to ride our bikes. I live in sheer panic when I ride my bike. I was hit by a car riding my bike a few months ago because the green light for cars is also the walk sign. So when your kids are crossing the street, crossing the side is safer to jaywalk because you could look and make sure that there's no one turning than it is to cross at the walk sign when the cars also have the green light.
I'm so glad you brought this up because you remind me that when I lived in the neighborhood at 105th in Amsterdam and at 100th in Columbus, it was very confusing if I was in a car and you were making that left turn on Broadway and going across the island. There would actually be two lights. There would, one in the middle and one at the end of the intersection. And I don't know to this day if you get through the first one and then the second one is red, if you can go.
I'm probably one of a handful of people in the city that know the answer to that. The answer to that is if the center median is less than 30 feet, you may proceed even though you're facing a red light. In the case of Broadway, it's narrower than 30 feet. And therefore, you can continue unless there are signs posted, and they may be warranted.
But the car coming up Broadway or down Broadway on the second half of that turn has a green light at that moment?
Yes, it has a green light. And obviously, if you're making the left in front of that car, you have to yield to that car. But nonetheless, if you can make it across, you can cross. And yes, indeed, the pedestrian has the walk, and you have the right to continue straight through.
Jennifer in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I want to certainly thank you for this topic, and I want to echo what a lot of what some of the other callers have said. I heard the Assemblyman O'Donnell speak last week at the Community Board 9 meeting, and I'm just constantly perplexed for the, I don't know, 15 or 20 years that I've lived in New York, the lack of yielding to pedestrians with a walk sign. So I know that other people have spoken about this, but it's just, I don't understand. Is this a moving violation or not? And if so, why not?
The answer is it is a moving violation. It's occasionally enforced, and I'm absolute agreement with you. It should be enforced more.
Jennifer, thank you. Here is a clip of Mayor de Blasio. This is just 10 seconds, and he's a little bit off mic here, so you have to listen carefully, but it's just 10 seconds. In response to a question about the jaywalking arrest on 96th at Broadway, he defends this as part of a larger policy. Listen.
There is no larger policy in terms of jaywalking and ticketing jaywalking. That's not part of our plan, but it is something a local precinct commander can act on if they perceive there to be a real danger.
And let me correct what I said setting up that clip. He said there is no larger policy in terms of jaywalking and ticketing and jaywalking. That's not part of our plan, but it is something a local precinct commander can act on if they perceive there to be a real danger. So it's not part of his Vision Zero to get to zero pedestrian deaths.
Yeah, and I would recommend that he really emphasize the vulnerable users. Those are the pedestrians, the bike riders, the failure to yield to both of them, and that his traffic engineering department within the DOT take a look at engineering measures that really cut down on fatalities. And there have been lots of studies that demonstrate what you can do in urban areas, such as better lighting, pedestrian refuge islands. And I would also recommend that there be a forensic team. Brian, every year on New York City streets, it's the equivalent of a 747 crashes, and we lose close to 300 people. Mm-hmm. The NTSB would study that for years. And I recommend that we do the same thing for pedestrian and traffic fatalities in New York.
Jabril in Manhattan, a taxi driver who wants to call out another intersection nearby to there, I think. Jabril, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes. Good morning, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
There are certain factors that contribute into a lot of accidents in the city here now. Whoever is designing the street right now in the city doesn't drive in the city. Because if they do, they would not design the street the way they design it now. For instance, like on 96th Street and Broadway right now, what's happening is they have a green left turn light. So what happened, the left turn light comes after the ones that the lights that are going straight ahead. So pedestrians that are waiting to cross the street, they always look for the light that goes straight again. So once that light stops, they're assuming that the pedestrian green light is going to appear now. And what happened is the left turn light is going to appear. So people try to turn left while pedestrians are assuming that their light is going to turn green. And that's the problem over there. And secondly, on 86th Street and Central Park West, there are two lanes there. One lane they designed out to turn left, and the other lane is going straight. So there's a lot of traffic happening there. Now, once you appear there, you see left turn lane, you try to squish to the right side to go straight ahead. So that's causing a lot of traffic there again. So whoever is designing this, the street should do a better job, or they should employ some cab drivers to help in designing.
Absolutely. Employ the cab drivers, because who knows better. Thank you, Jabril. But bottom line, in a way, Sam Schwartz, it's a crowded city. People are trying to go straight, right, and left at busy intersections all the time. Are there perfect solutions?
There are many things that work. None of them are perfect. Some of them will upset the driver. I think Jabril brought up a good point, and that is we have to see it through the eyes of the driver as well as the pedestrian. And he gave a wonderful description of the problem when you have a left turn phase at a very busy pedestrian crossing. But there's been a lot of research into urban traffic safety, and there are a lot of measures such as better lighting, Most of the crashes do occur, the fatal crashes at night. The policies that your first listener talked about, where we put cars on streets versus highways, which, as you know, Brian, we talked about the tolling policy of New York City, puts probably 30 to 50 million miles more on New York City streets versus highways because we invite people to go over the free bridges. That results in casualties. There are signal timing changes that could be made. I'm not a big fan of the political solutions, just lower the speed limits. In fact, there are some studies that say when you just blanketly lower limits, you increase the crash rate because some people continue to drive at the faster rate and some at the slower rate, and the difference of speed then becomes greater.
The city under Bloomberg had been redesigning some light cycles at some intersections so that there are walk signs for periods of time with no cars having a green light. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, leading pedestrian intervals, and it's something I introduced back when I was traffic commissioner. That is an absolutely good strategy to use, and I would recommend continuing to do that.
You know, one of the things that's so sad about the relatively minor jaywalking incident making it onto the front page of the Post, and of course very sad that that elderly gentleman had his face bloodied and didn't understand what was going on with the police. But the reason that there were so many photos of Mr. Wong being arrested is that news organizations were covering the death of a pedestrian earlier that morning at that very intersection.
Yes. Well, you know, when I look at the fatality, one was the medical, the doctor who apparently did cross mid-block, but the other one that occurred right at the intersection, it looked like the pedestrian had the right-of-way. As a number of you listeners talked about, there is a left-turning movement where there is an arrow that allows for that left-turn movement, and left turns are done much faster than right turns. And we probably need to look at redesigning that intersection to slow down the left turns.
Faster than right turns. That's because cars feel they need to speed through it once they make the turn because of oncoming traffic?
It's partly that, but also the geometrics. It's not as tight to make a left turn as it is to make a right turn.
Before you go, you issued a blueprint last year for modernizing the relationship overall between pedestrians and bicycles and cars. And also on adding East River tolls, but lowering other tolls. Do you have Mayor de Blasio's ear at all? Do you think any of your proposals are being seriously considered by the new administration?
Well, I certainly hope so. I did meet with Mayor de Blasio when he was a candidate, and he seemed to be eager to learn more about it. I met with his current transportation commissioner when she was Undersecretary of Transportation, and we're hoping that they do respond, because this will result in fewer fatalities on city streets just because fewer miles will be driven on city streets.
Listeners, continue to post on our webpage some of the other dangerous intersections in New York City in addition to the ones that we've been focusing on in this conversation because they've been in the news. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show and Sam Schwartz. Gridlock, Sam. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Right now, though, a call in for anyone who blogs or tweets about your illness or your health. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you blog or tweet about your health or your illness, we invite you to call in right now and do a little oral history. 212-433-9692. Tell everyone why you do it, what you choose to share, and why and what you think that does for you or your loved ones or your other readers. 212-433-9692. The reason I ask, as some of you may have figured out already, is the online firestorm that's been going on over two newspaper articles that raise questions about a woman who tweets regularly about the details of her battle with cancer, a woman named Lisa Adams at Sloan Kettering. She tweets at Adams Lisa. The articles were by Emma Keller of The Guardian and New York Times columnist Bill Keller, as her husband, yes, husband and wife newspaper columnist, wrote about the same woman with cancer 4 days apart, January 8th and January 12th. They had slightly different angles. But the pushback was fast and furious from cancer patients and others who felt their right to communicate and to manage their illnesses in their own ways was being questioned. One article questioned whether readers of these blogs or Twitter feeds would be more dignified if we turned away. That was in one of the killer articles. The other compared the tweeting cancer patient Lisa Adams and her attempt to treat her cancer aggressively with one of Keller's in-laws' choices to die without the most aggressive treatment. My impression is that that relative was probably a much older man. The tweeter is a woman in her 40s with three kids. So the pushback against the Kellers has been fierce. The Guardian even removed Emma Keller's piece from their site, which raises other journalistic questions, though you can find the piece elsewhere. And the web is all kinds of, you know, full of all kinds of pushback articles. If you just kind of search some keywords around this topic, you'll find pieces like, if you don't like people tweeting about cancer, don't read it. Guardian's in-house critic, divisive cancer column, shouldn't be restored to the website. What Bill Keller doesn't get, there is no right way to die. No shame. Bill Keller bullies cancer patient, The Nation. Gawker, dear Bill Keller, I have cancer. Is that okay? So you get a sense of what those two articles have generated in terms of angry response. But really, I'm not too interested in the debate over the Kellers either way, or what should or shouldn't be written, or what questions should be raised or not raised in prominent newspaper articles. For the sake of this call-in, or the ethics or the sensitivity, insensitivity of the journalism involved, I just thought that with all this going on, and many of you out there who probably do write publicly about whatever your health challenges are, probably being aware of this, I would let some of you who do blog or tweet about your health or your illnesses just call in and do a little oral history. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I just want to give you voice here to tell everyone why you do it, what you choose to share, and how you decide, and why, and what you think that does for you or your loved ones or your other readers. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. It's a call-in for anyone who blogs or tweets about your illness or your health. 212-433-9692, and we will take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we have a lot of people calling in who blog about your health or about your illnesses. So we're just going to go to the phones and hear some of you at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, well, let's see. How about Amy in Manhattan? Amy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you blog about?
Well, I have a blog called Boo Cancer, You Suck, and it's where I chronicled my own journey with breast cancer.
And why did you do that? Why did you set up a blog? Why did you title it that, since you shouted the title right out?
Well, I titled it that because the day that I was actually getting diagnosed, I kind of, like, blanked out for a moment, and the only thing I remember thinking was, oh, boo, this really sucks. And so then I thought, oh, yeah, I should start a blog about this. And then I kind of was like, where am I going with this? And I had to snap back to reality for a moment.
Where did you go with it? Because that's a good first, you know, first reaction. Yeah, okay, cancer sucks. Everybody can agree about that. And then what did you do?
Well, then what I discovered was that, you know, when you find out something like that, obviously there's people that you want to tell what's going on, and it can be hard to make those phone calls, and then it can be hard to process all the new information you're getting that's kind of scary and overwhelming, and then to keep reiterating it to people who really care about you, but, like, it's hard when you haven't fully digested what's happening and you have to keep talking about it. So I figured if I started this blog, initially it was a place I wanted my friends and family to go to on a daily basis and just kind of see where my head was at and what's going on, but then it really started to grow from there. And a lot of people that had cancer or had cancer and were in remission started to contact me, and it just kind of became something bigger than I ever thought it would be. And it was a really wonderful way to go through something so difficult.
It sounds like one of your motivations was so you wouldn't have to have the same conversation 50 times with all the people who are your friends and relatives. Is that part of what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Just because there's certain things that are pretty hard to think about, let alone talk about over and over. And so I felt like, you know, a good place for everyone to kind of turn to would be this blog, where I would write everything pretty much as I was processing it or feeling it. It was almost like a journal in a way, you know, because on the blog I put pictures of everything I was going through and really chronicled my whole journey. So it's a place where people I knew could follow along and keep up to date on what was going on. And then if they had any other questions beyond that, obviously they could get in touch with me. But it was also a place for people who have relatives that had cancer to kind of really get a little bit more of an understanding of what it's like to go through that.
Doing this on Tumblr, which is so image friendly, have you included images or is it just a text blog?
No, it's lots of visuals as well. I really, you know, and some of them I had to put little warnings on. Like at one point I got a bone marrow biopsy and did a video of it.
Why?
Because that's just a part of my journey. It's a choice I made. You know, I documented the whole thing, and I really wanted to show, at the time I was 31 when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And, you know, I really wanted to show what this whole process was like. I mean, on the blog, you see when I have hair, you see the moment my hair started coming out, you see me having to give myself shots in the stomach or, you know, it's part of whatever I'm going through with treatment. And I just think it's important because, you know, we all know that obviously cancer sucks and it's a bummer and it's a horrible disease, but we don't always know what someone actually has to go through.
Did you follow this whole Keller thing and the pushback at all?
And the what? I'm sorry?
The pushback to these articles in the Times and the Guardian, or is this the first you've heard of that?
Oh, no, this is the first. I just had a friend text me and say that that you were talking about people who block about their illnesses.
Yeah. Good. Well, yeah. I'm glad you called. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Amy at Boo Cancer You Suck on Tumblr. B-O-O, cancer, letter U, suck on Tumblr, that blog. Get some pickup on Tumblr from what we could see. Paula in East Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Paula, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well. I relate so much to the last caller because I, too, have breast cancer and decided to, you know, I didn't make an official blog. I did this kind of mass email, and I sort of called it a blog. I think I was afraid for other people to see what I had written until it was all over. And now I've turned it into a book, and it's called The Year I Lost My Breasts and Got Some New Ones.
You just called to plug your book? No, I'm kidding.
No. I haven't even published it yet, so no, I'm not plugging anything. But I do want to, I just, you know, the point of kind of that title is, I think what I did when I was writing was to really sort of infuse humor in the whole thing, which really helped me. I wrote a lot with a lot of irony and kind of made fun of myself and made fun of the process as I was going through it in a way to sort of help me get through it. And at the same time, people were able to see that I was okay.
Somebody sent me a link to what looks like a really, really great site called, of all things, Cancer is So Funny. And it's a blog by somebody who, it's actually a book and a blog by somebody who has or had cancer and wanted to find the humor in it, you know, as you say, is part of what you did. So I'm looking at one of the cartoons on the site with the caption, "I feel kind of skinny." You know, because, you know, and it
that
just
was a little bit of a perk. I talked about being able to lose weight without having to go on any difficult diet. You know, the pounds kind of fall off because nothing tastes good and you have no appetite and, you know, the chemo is messing with your stomach and your and the nausea. So, yeah, I mean, so yeah, I think there are ways to sort of find those funny pieces in it and to move forward. And I think the other piece was that from the very minute I was diagnosed, the first question that anybody asks is, am I going to live? And I think I was given pretty much the assurance that I was going to live. I was stage 2, and it was early, and I was treatable. And I think it's so much easier to have that kind of attitude when you know you're going to live. So that's a big difference. I think that if somebody, my diagnosis was terminal, I think I would have had a much harder time. I don't think I would have been writing anything quite so witty.
I guess not. Yeah. Did you follow this Guardian Times thing? Were you aware of it at all, or is this the first you've heard?
You know, I read the Times all the time, and I'm trying to. I didn't catch what you said in the beginning of the show, so I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Well, it was an op-ed by, or I don't know if op-ed's the right word, or an essay or an op-ed by their columnist, Bill Keller. I think it ran in the 13th of January print edition on their website. But I'm not going to re-get into it. I said we're not doing this to have that debate. It's just that if you were aware of it and had some reactions to it, you know, I would have been curious. But, Paula, thank you very much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let's go next to Eliana in Scarsdale. Eliana, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
And you blog about an illness?
I do. My blog is Punchy Mommy Believes in Life, and it's my journey with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I was diagnosed when I was 31 in October of 2012.
And so why did you decide to do this?
Well, unlike the previous blogger, no one ever told me that I might die, but I believe I was dying when I was diagnosed, and there was nothing funny about what I went through. And I was largely incoherent during treatment, but shortly after treatment, I started to feel a lot of anxiety and depression and a lot of PTSD symptoms. You know, I was like replaying images or situations that I went through. And so I started blogging to release them and to kind of get them out into the world and just, you know, let them go. And it really has helped me heal.
Do you care who reads it?
In the beginning, I didn't care, but now that I, you know, have been in remission for almost a year, you know, the aftermath of cancer is really difficult, especially for a young adult. And, you know, I'm kind of getting into some darker areas. And so sometimes I think before I publish something, because, you know, I don't want my mom to get too upset and, you know, I don't want my relatives to really get too upset, but it's, you know, something that I'm dealing with. So I usually just kind of put it out there regardless.
And do you expect to continue to do this throughout your treatment?
Well, so I've completed treatment, but I think recovery, the emotional scars are going to take a really long time to kind of fade away. And so I foresee that I'm going to be doing this for a long time.
Thank you, Eliana. Good luck.
Thank you.
And Lori in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you. I actually started writing. I was diagnosed 2 years ago with stage 3 breast cancer. My twins at the time were 3 years old. All of my family lives far away, like in Louisiana, Portland, Oregon. And when I told them about my diagnosis, I basically said, you have 48 hours to tell any other family members that you want about this before I post a notice on Facebook. Mm. And when I posted it on Facebook, it was more not to just, you know, tell my story. It was more because my family lives in South Louisiana where there's lots of gossiping, and I didn't want them to have to deal with people all of a sudden saying, oh, Lori's dying of cancer. We hear Lori's cancer. It was a way for me to tell them what I'm going through and what was actually happening.
So it wasn't only a way to communicate your own story, it was a way to control your own story.
Exactly. And then when I started that, as I started continuing it on Facebook, it turned into the blog and then turned into what I have now as the website is badrightbreast.com. And I actually had my documentary friend follow me through my entire process, which we videotaped from the doctor actually telling me the results of my pathology reports, going in with me for my mastectomy, going in through radiation and chemo, at home having my 3-year-old girls shave my head, And so it helped not only my family, but also friends. It helped friends of mine who are in the medical industry who deal with patients to let them understand what's happening from the patient's point of view. And throughout all of it, I continue to say, this is my story. This is my diagnosis. Each person is individual. What happens to me may not happen to you. Everybody is unique and individual.
I don't think we could prove this scientifically, but do you think in any way it helps you heal?
It does, in fact, because it I actually do. I think getting it out, getting the words out on paper, what Amy said at the beginning is not having to completely rehash it over and over again. People can go and read it for you. People were wanting to know how to help. You were easily being able to tell them how to help. And I have to actually say, at the end of my, when I finished radiation, I did 4.5 months of chemo and 6 weeks of radiation. I was felt like I was mentally fine throughout all of it. And when I was done with radiation, it was the most depressed I had ever been. Because you constantly feel like you're doing something. And then between that time when you're not doing anything and when you're officially told that you don't have cancer anymore, it's that waiting game all over again. So being able to write through that helped get through that depression.
Do you read other people's cancer blogs? I think one thing we're learning from this segment, because our lines lit up right away, and, you know, we could spend the next 4 hours on this if we had the time, just going through caller, 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 caller. People are doing this. Do you read other people's cancer blogs?
Yeah, because there are times when you feel like this is only happening to you. There are times when you feel like you are so alone, and in reality, you have to take a step back. You have to get out of your head, and you have to remind yourself, this has happened to many women before, this is happening to women now, and this is going to happen to many people afterwards. And so reading other blogs reminds you of that. And the op-ed and the Times, you know, I mean, I took it with a grain of salt, all of it, because people are going to judge no matter what. You know, even when you're going through cancer, you have this big perspective of life, of being on the subway in New York or walking down the street, and this idea that no one around you has any idea what you're going through. And then you start looking at other people in different ways, thinking, well, now that I look like cancer, that I'm completely bald, you get these looks, and you start realizing you have no idea what cancer has done to that person, whether they cared for someone or saw someone die or whether they went through it, you know. So it makes you have a different perspective on life.
Did you feel judged by the article? Because he might have said that he didn't intend to judge anybody's choices. He said that explicitly about the blogger and tweeter who he wrote about, just that some people do it in a different way, like his father-in-law, who chose not to fight so aggressively. I doubt that he'd question you, diagnosed at age 36, you know, doing everything you can medically to fight the cancer.
You know, it's a person's opinion. I mean, you can't, it affects everyone in different ways. And so I think judging people for the way that they react to it is just not right, because it is going to affect a person. Each person is going to be affected in a different way. And how someone wants to tell their story, you know, and how someone is going to react to that, that's kind of why we're all here.
Lori, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Michael in Hell's Kitchen, our first male caller in this whole segment, and to talk about, I think, a very different kind of health or illness blog that he maintains. Michael, thank you very much for calling. You're on WNYC.
How are you doing, Brian? I appreciate it, and I've been on your show before. I'm really concerned with, you know, my narrative not being crowded by, you know, the American public, you know, or the government or all of these entities that hide the narrative of those going through maladies. And I'm being really particular as far as, like, those going through war and readjustment. So I've taken away a lot of my blogs because I don't want, you know, negative effects in regards to employability. So that's another issue that we don't really look at.
So you were at war. You came back from one of the wars, and you have been blogging about that, the long-lasting effects of that on you. Am I understanding you right?
Yeah, I've been talking about you know, the different struggles regarding readjustment and the medical issues regarding war and the home front. And also, you know, this whole thing about having a voice, because it's very important for those going through not just, you know, readjustment from war, but, you know, much like the piece pointed out, you know, there's an issue of being able to kind of survive in this, you know, weak, debilitating state. And that's not all that popular in our society. So, you know, I just think it's important to have these voices out there. Now, I know, you know, Columbia University and a couple other places have these narrative medicine programs, and they're fantastic. And I know Yale School of Medicine, I will
I didn't know about that. What does that mean, a narrative medicine program? Helping patients tell their
research program up at Columbia University, focusing on getting the stories out there from those who were ill, you know, so that person who had written the article, as well as people like myself, we can kind of like have our voices out there circulating and not have a doctor give our voice, not have a general give our voice, not have an organization give our voice, like a dominant veteran organization that has hegemony over the voices on other veterans. You know, we can put our voices out there through the internet, through, you know, paper, what have you.
So I think I hear a tension that you're grappling with as a vet dealing with whatever ongoing health effects you're dealing with, which is that on the one hand, you want to control your narrative and you want to have a public narrative and put it out there. On the other hand, you're the first caller to raise a concern about employability when people see that you've been struggling with whatever. So how do you resolve that?
Well, I just continue to pursue what I pursue in regards to my treatments. But at the same time, I'm also encouraging others to not just present their narratives according to, like, people in the media or the government or what have you want you to present your narrative, but to let the narrative flow. And not only that, for the narrative to kind of like present more questions to society, you know, I think that's the other important thing. I think, you know, in many ways, you know, we're told, you know, tell us your war story. Well, hell, you know, I want you to hear what I'm going through right now. You know, I don't want to be seen in Restrepo and then the story stops. You know, my appointments day to day, as well as managing my work schedule, picking up my son, doing all these things, that's important in my readjustment and my health reintegration. So I think it's important to look at multiplicity, and I really appreciate you letting me have this voice, you know, and not having like an organization or, you know, a hospital kind of like determine.
Speak for you. Michael, yes. Thanks again for your service in Iraq, and thanks for calling up and saying what you said today. All right, let's do one more, and we're going to do one. We did somebody coming from a little different place, Philip in Wayne, who told our screener that his girlfriend talks about her illness all the time all over social media. Philip, did I get that right?
Yeah. My girlfriend, she has a POTS. It's a postural orthostatic tachycardia. It's what we would call an invisible illness. She looks fine. You know, it's not like cancer where you can see she's ill, or it's not like something else where you know and people are aware.
Sometimes you can with cancer, sometimes you can't, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. But at least you know. So with POTS, it's a rather large community, actually. It's not just her. There are groups on Facebook, but she has something on Tumblr called POTS Problems, where she communicates with her other people who are sick. And there's a lot of solidarity in this group of theirs, because a lot of people on the outside don't really understand. Because you'll see and you imagine, well, she looks okay, but really, like, getting up in the morning is a struggle. Like, I was going to tell her to call, but she's still in bed, and I wanted her to have this voice. I wanted her.
So you're representing her. How about for you as her boyfriend, seeing her stuff all over social media? Do you ever cringe? Do you ever yearn for your or her privacy. She's making her own choices, so she can yearn for her own privacy, I guess, if she chooses to. But how about you as a third party in this?
I feel immensely proud of what she's done. It's a very difficult situation she's in because POTS is rather debilitating. I had never heard about it until we had gotten together and she had told me. And as it progressed, I've seen how awful it can be.
A heart condition? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a heart condition. It heavily affects your blood pressure and a host of other bodily functions, where standing up too quick, you know, makes you fall over. Just a host of different things where it just makes life incredibly difficult. Getting up in the morning is difficult. Going to work, a lot of people who have been diagnosed with POTS really can't go to work. So a lot of them are on disability. As it gets worse, a lot of people just become bedridden for majority of their time.
And so what?
Completely able people just have to stay home.
What does she get in the long run from blogging it?
Being able to talk to someone else, being able to find people who have the same issues is, I think, really important to her. And I think it's important to everyone who has any kind of disease or issue where someone else can't appreciate what's going on with you. It's like meeting family members you've never had. It's like finding a sister you've lost a long time ago, I think. Because we found someone recently close by who also suffers from POTS, and she was really excited over that, to be able to share mm-hmm. her problems with someone in person. And I guess that's important about it, too, is that community. It's not just being able to talk about what's wrong with you, but being able to talk to someone else when something's wrong with them, and then you can be there for them. And
yeah,
that's what's important.
What a great side benefit for a disease that's pretty rare, to find somebody near you and then get together in person as well. Philip, thank you very much for chiming in. And that's where we're going to leave it. As I said, we could go for hours on this if we had that time, because so many of you want to share what you blog or tweet or otherwise share publicly about your struggle with an illness. So you can continue the conversation on our website if you want at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Feel free to post a link if you want people to go to your site and read what you're writing, or to your Twitter feed or whatever, and you can join the conversation that's there at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Again, thanks to everybody for opening up and for your phone calls. Still to come, or coming up next, we will talk to Tim Harford from the Financial Times, a.k.a. the undercover economist. Stay with us.